The House of Lords Reform Bill is currently before Parliament, and House of Lords Reform is something that's been discussed for a very long time. It's more than 100 years since the Parliament Act was passed, and it changed the balance of power between the House of Commons and the House of Lords, making the Commons the more dominant chamber. But when that reform was enacted, it was explicitly said to be a stopgap measure pending full reform of the House of Lords by means of a shift to an elected upper chamber. In July 2012, 80% of people surveyed by Ipsos Mori supported House of Lords reform, although few of them thought it was an important priority. But while there's a broad consensus that the House of Lords needs to be reformed, there's less agreement about how it should be reformed. And so several consultations on from the Blair government's first attempt at this, there is a sense that we're simply going round in circles. There are two difficulties with the way in which the debate is conducted about House of Lords reform. First, there's a great focus on questions of composition. How should people get to the House of Lords? Should they be appointed or elected or get there in some other way? This is obviously an important question, but it's one that can't really be addressed properly unless prior issues are considered. What powers does the House of Lords have? What should its powers be? And what function does it serve? Why do we want to have a second chamber at all? The second area of difficulty is that the debate focuses on questions of legitimacy without very much attention to questions of efficacy, to questions about how the House of Lords ought to be composed in order to deliver the role that we want to see. So this dual focus on questions of composition and legitimacy leads to the simplistic conclusion that the House of Lords must be elected. A better way of looking at this is to ask firstly, what is the House of Lords' proper role? What do we actually want it to achieve? And then to ask what approach to its composition will best enable it to fulfill that role. Finally, we need to consider whether that approach to its composition is one that can be reconciled with concerns about legitimacy. Let me explain how the House of Lords works today. The House of Lords is composed of around 825 peers. The vast majority of these are life peers. The 700 life peers have been appointed by successive prime ministers to serve for the whole of their lives. The next group is the 92 hereditary peers. These are left over following the House of Lords Reform Act in 1999. That act removed the majority, but not all, of the hereditaries. And the other significant group are the 26 Church of England bishops who serve in the House of Lords in recognition of the established status of the Church of England. What then of the powers and role of the House of Lords today? The House of Lords plays two crucial constitutional functions. It scrutinizes the work of the government, and it operates as a revising chamber, scrutinizing the legislation which the government brings to the House of Commons. In particular, the House of Lords can and does prompt the House of Commons to think again. But importantly, the House of Lords has no power of veto. The most that it can do is delay the enactment of legislation by 1 year. This recognizes that the House of Lords does not have the same claim to a democratic mandate as the elected House of Commons. Rather, the House of Lords operates as a counterweight to the executive-controlled House of Commons. And this is especially important in our constitutional system. In many countries, there is an external constraint on Parliament in the form of a written constitution which can be enforced by the courts, courts that can ultimately strike down legislation if Parliament acts unconstitutionally. Because the British Parliament is sovereign, the courts do not have that ultimate power of control. And so it's crucial that within our parliamentary system we have an internal check and balance on the powers of the government and the House of Commons, and that's the crucial function which the House of Lords today fulfills. What would the House of Lords Reform Bill do if enacted? The first thing to say is that the role and powers of the House of Lords would not be significantly altered if the bill were enacted. Instead, the principal focus is on the composition of the House of Lords, who sits in it, and how they get there. First, the House of Lords Reform Bill would expel the remaining hereditary peers. Secondly, there would be 90 appointed peers. And thirdly, by far the largest group would be the new 360 elected members of the House of Lords. They would each serve a 15-year term and would not be allowed to stand for re-election. There would also be a small number of additional members, Church of England bishops and a few government ministers. All of this raises two key questions. First, would these changes reduce or enhance the efficacy of the House of Lords? Would they help it or hinder it in achieving its constitutional objectives? The key need here is for complementarity, for two chambers that complement each other and don't simply replicate each other's work. It's particularly important that we have a House of Lords that is not dominated by political parties. The House of Lords needs to bring a different perspective from the House of Commons and to act as a counterweight to the partisan House of Commons controlled by the government. On this argument, then, the proposals may not enhance the House of Lords' efficacy. They might actually undermine it. An elected House of Lords would very likely be a House of Lords controlled to some extent by political parties and possibly, therefore, by the government. But secondly, are these changes needed? Are they a necessary evil to make the House of Lords acceptable and legitimate? Again, I think the answer is no. The House of Lords does not need the same kind of legitimacy as the House of Commons, because in the first place, it's not the House of Commons' constitutional equal. In other words, the balance of power between the two chambers, the Commons' status as a superior chamber, and the Lords' limitation to only delaying legislation, means that built into the system is recognition of the House of Lords' lack of democratic credentials. This means that the lack of those credentials doesn't deprive the House of Lords of legitimacy. Of course, none of this means that the present system is perfect. Far from it. There's an irresistible argument for expelling the remaining hereditary peers, and it's good that the House of Lords Reform Bill proposes to do that. And there's a strong argument, too, for changing how people are appointed. In particular, for moving away from the current system of prime ministerial patronage, whereby most appointments are made in effect on the prime minister's recommendation. It's not my purpose in this talk to make detailed proposals about how the system ought to work. Rather, my point is a simpler and prior one, that the debate has to be framed appropriately. And that means recognising that the House of Lords has and will continue to have limited powers, that its role is as a complementary revising chamber, and that in the UK, because of our particular constitutional architecture, there is a need for a second chamber that can act as a counterweight to the executive-controlled House of Commons. Looked at in this way, the argument in favour of an elected, or mainly elected, House of Lords is wide of the mark for at least two reasons. First, it conflates concerns about legitimacy and democracy by failing to appreciate the wider institutional context. And secondly, it fails to acknowledge that constitutional reform of this type and scale can't sensibly be undertaken as an isolated standalone project. If the British constitution were different, if, for example, there was a written constitution that subjected Parliament's authority to court-enforced limits, then what we'd look for in a second chamber might be different. We might, for instance, be less concerned with equipping it to act in part as a constitutional watchdog, able to counterbalance the Commons and the government. And in that situation, arguments about the composition of the House of Lords might play out differently. But to assume that an elected upper chamber is right for Britain, because that is what other democracies have, is insensitive to the peculiarities of our own system. Perhaps, then, the reason why House of Lords reform remains unfinished business a century after it was started, and the reason why it might remain unfinished business for some time to come, is ultimately because we're reluctant to locate the project of House of Lords reform within a wider framework of constitutional reform. In other words, if the rest of the constitution is left as it is, we shouldn't be surprised to find that the House of Lords we presently have is not, after all, as bad as we might at first suppose.